Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And welcome to another edition of the podcast. It's another week and another week of action by the Trump administration. Always something going on. We want to focus in on that. I'm Paul Lisnick, your host for Behind the Curtain. And this week, of course, President Trump announcing the end of the DACA program, the Dreamer program. The program started through an executive action under the Obama administration that allowed young people who were brought here through no fault of their own, but by their families, and now find themselves in a situation of being illegal. The DACA program let them stay. And the Trump administration action now says, sorry, guys, you need to go, unless Congress steps in and does something. Let's pull this apart a little bit, talk about the implications of it. I can think of no better guest anywhere than Michael Golden, because he is not only a senior fellow with the Adlai Stevenson Center for Democracy, but the author of a great book called Unlock Congress. He actually has lots of ideas of how Congress might be able to work together if they would listen, if they would do something about it. Michael, welcome to the podcast. They don't listen, do they?
Even when they try to listen, there are impediments in the way that don't allow them to get what they want to get done. But yes, it's a split country and it's a split Congress, and the reelection imperative has a lot to do with it. This goes back to not getting comprehensive immigration done for many years. And the Senate came close several years ago.
Right.
Congress did, when the Senate voted for a Gang of Eight comprehensive immigration bill, 68-32, an overwhelming bipartisan vote. And John Boehner in the House wouldn't even bring it up for a vote, although it probably would have passed with bipartisan votes if it weren't for the so-called Hastert rule. But, this will put more pressure on Congress to get this done. But it's a toss-up, Paul, because there's been pressure on Congress to get it done for many years.
Right. And by the way, when you said Hastert rule, for those not in the know, that's referring to the fact that under Denny Hastert, it was required that a majority of, at that time, Republicans would have supported something before it would be presented for a vote, not just the majority of the House, but a majority of Republicans.
Right. Republicans in the House caucus. Exactly. And the other thing is, though, that this decision today, some people are calling it terribly cold hearted. Some people are calling it inconsequential because he's just pushing it down the road. The president is for 6 months. This is not that different in a way from Donald Trump making other guarantees that were just not practical in terms of getting it done legislatively. He said that he was going to repeal and replace Obamacare on day one. He said he was going to end DACA on day one. Day one was, I think, January 21st.
Well,
our government doesn't work that way. And so, he had nowhere to go but to do this sort of little mealy-mouth thing. And in my humble opinion, it was pretty cowardly to have Jeff Sessions go out there and do it and not face the cameras and the press himself, because he's the president of the United States.
Well, and of course, in that Trump-supporting base, which Democrats say is dwindling, but certainly he maintains, we'll just call it around a third, 30% of the country, he can do no wrong. And and I happen to agree with you that with Jeff Sessions making the announcement, I mean, it's not unprecedented to have a cabinet member make an announcement for the president. It's happened before. It happened under Reagan. It happened under Eisenhower. And it's not as though he picked Nikki Haley to do it. He picked, a relevant division, meaning justice, to make the announcement. But I agree with you. This clearly is such an issue that the president owned that it does make you wonder why he wouldn't face the music and speak to the press. He did issue a statement afterwards in which he basically tried to talk about acting with heart, and acting with heart means that Congress has to get his act together. And, if you're going to give the president credit for something, here's where he could have a point, which is, look, if he didn't do this and life just went on as it was, maybe the next president, maybe a President Pence or somebody else who steps in, would have done what he did. At someday, the music was going to be faced on this topic, and that the only thing that would have ever saved it is Congress acting. So what he did was pulled the plug, and he's forcing Congress to act. But as you said, Congress has to get its act together. They couldn't do anything with Affordable Care Act. The tax reform stuff seems to, we'll see, but doesn't seem to be going anywhere. They're supposed to be dealing with debt ceilings. They're supposed to be dealing with budgets. All that stuff has to be dealt with. Hurricane Harvey relief. They can't walk and chew gum at the same time. How are they supposed to do all of this and now add DACA on top of it?
Yeah, look, the list is long, and there's plenty of acrimony between the president and members of his own party in Congress. But the other thing is, to your point, yes, this may, if this pushes forward a solution to get through Congress on immigration that's broader than just DACA and addresses some of the real structural problems of the immigration, really non-system, as I like to call the healthcare non-system in this country, then that would be great. But you also have to keep in mind, this is a larger macro problem of Congress, and it affects other issues. Healthcare, look, it took 80 years to try to cover more people under the Democrats, and we still haven't fixed the parts of Obamacare, whatever it is, 9 years later, 8 years later. It's the same thing with immigration. The last comprehensive immigration legislation was Simpson-Mazzoli in 1986. I mean, you're talking about 30 years. So it gets worse and worse. These non-systems, the way they don't operate properly when legislation is not passed. And tax reform is the same thing. It's been 30 years since Reagan's tax reform. So what happens? The tax code gets fatter and fatter. There's more and more loopholes, and it gets more difficult to actually solve. It's sort of a vicious cycle.
So here we are. I mean, the action is done. Congress is now on the clock, 6 months to go. And by the way, take Hurricane Harvey just for a moment. It's not really a topic for today. But the point of it is, when people say, well, they're getting billions of dollars for that kind of hurricane relief. And the reason that that may not happen is because, although there will be a Hurricane Harvey relief plan, there will be other senators and congressmen who start putting on funding and attach it to that bill for the bridge they wanted to build and for the who knows what other pork they have in mind. And that's what ends up killing these bills. And my question is, do you think the Congress has the guts to take DACA and just deal with it on its own when in that group you have Freedom Caucus members and other factions of the Republican Party who actually support the destruction of DACA? Do they have the votes?
No,
do the Democrats have the votes with some Republicans to even pass it?
It's a good question. It's a really good question. But you know what? It's sort of like, I think maybe Churchill said it. I hope I'm not getting this quote wrong, that the Americans do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possible solution. I'm paraphrasing. But it's sort of like Congress, too. You know, Hurricane Sandy, their relief, there was all this stuff. And I remember the exact words of Governor Christie at the time. People are fed up with the palace intrigue of Washington and Capitol Hill, and they finally got it done. Now, you know, I would imagine that they will get that done, the Harvey relief. And don't forget, it may stretch into Irma relief before it's all done.
That's right.
It looks like a Category 5 that's moving toward Florida.
Right.
I think that they'll get that done. I think it's the bigger things, Paul. It's immigration. Look, tax reform will be incredibly difficult. I think tax cuts, just tax cuts, which most Republicans want, that will be difficult enough. And then you've got still a healthcare system that's not working. That problem doesn't go away just because Congress stops trying to solve it in a bipartisan fashion. And not to get too much off topic, but there was an article over the weekend about reforms in the state of Minnesota, bipartisan, more so reforms that have strengthened the health insurance exchanges. There are ways to solve some of these problems. Again, partisanship, rigged districts, the money in Congress, all that stuff makes it much more difficult for opposing viewpoints to work together, even when they want to, even when there's a common goal.
And isn't it dangerous to wait until, listen, DACA, they've basically given the date of early March. That's the 6 month point. And the issue is, when you're in March of 2018, what else is going on? Primaries. So if you're Congress and you want to do something about this, Paul Ryan, don't you think you got to do it almost immediately? Because if you're talking about this stuff in February and March, the challenges that incumbent members of Congress are going to face from their right or from their left, depending on where they are, it's going to be unsurmountable.
Well, and those campaigns are already actually going on and positioning and money and all of that. You're right. But keep in mind, this is another one of those, like, look, Donald Trump plays chicken almost with himself. He almost can't discern, I think, in his own reality, whether he's telling the truth or not. He just blows past it. Well, you got to remember that members of Congress and leaders in his party, they have to make actual calculations about whether he means it or not. When he says fire and fury to North Korea, okay, that's North Korea has to decide on. But our own members of Congress on the Republican side of the aisle, some of them are going to be calculating, does he mean it in 6 months, or will he extend it another 2 years because he doesn't have any spine and it's all bluster? Do we have to do this now, or can we just keep pushing it off or, wait till we get through the midterms? That's unfortunately a problem in our system, especially in the House where you have two-year terms, as you and I have talked about. There's always a calculation for the future. And how much words do Donald Trump's how much weight do Donald Trump's words carry anymore? I mean, this is a 6 month extension, and someone just asked his press secretary in the White House press briefing, Paul, well, in 6 months, is there a chance that, you know, this could go on, or is there, you know, and they don't provide an answer because they don't want to get boxed in. They're already boxed in on DACA, which is through Trump's own mouth in the campaign. That's why he had to do what he did today.
So because you understand how Congress works, Michael, let me ask you this. I'm already getting emails and, you know, from DACA people as though I'm going to have the answer to this. So I appreciate them reaching out, basically saying, how scared should I be? What's your answer to them?
Yeah, that's a boy. I have friends asking me the same thing. And I have some friends who are mighty, mighty upset for very personal reasons about this today. I mean, you can already see the protests that are going on. And the answer to that is, look, in our government, the president and the executive branch is not just the White House. It's all the executive agencies that carry out the laws, that execute the laws that Congress passes and the president signs. And, you know, a lot of that is subjective. Where, you know, you could make the argument right now that if all the illegal immigration laws were being followed, that we'd have even more deportations, that you know, ICE agents and other agencies would be ramping things up. So it's an unsatisfying answer. I don't know. I personally don't think that there's going to be huge number increases in this threat of people that are going to be affected by this. But I don't know because I'm not running the executive branch. I think that this is more of a dodge and more of a stop to his base and to the people that are pretty far right on this issue, that 33% you talked about. Yeah. And keep in mind, because you brought up his base and that, you know, it's almost become axiomatic that he can't do, his base will go nowhere. But I'll tell you, if this isn't followed through, and Congress doesn't pass a law, and there aren't more, you know, there aren't more stringent actions taken, you know, by the tough guy president, his base may not all be there in the midterms.
Well, here's also the problem. If Congress does get its act together and you and I talk in the future and go, oh, my God, they did it. They passed a DACA bill, you know, and they're good. And he signs it. Hasn't he just flew in the face of exactly the action he took today? Because his supporters don't say, you're right, this happened the wrong way. We need to do it the right way through Congress. His people have said, no, if you're here illegally, you've got to go. So signing a DACA bill, if it's some version of amnesty, which it would have to be, he loses those supporters or at least gets them angry anyway.
Well, and actually, so that's a great question because you've identified also in the question the just exactly why this has been so difficult for Congress to pass, even when there was a bipartisan majority likely in the House, because all of those Republicans that are in districts that want the same thing as the Trump base and have a harder line on it, they don't want this. But that's always the rub in our system, right? Not to get too academic about it, but you know, this government was designed as three branches, and it's difficult to get things done, even when there's an imperative to get it done.
And even when you control all three.
In the House and the Senate. Yeah, right, exactly.
It's tough. Michael Golden, I wish we could continue this conversation. We will at a future time. But before then, I encourage all my listeners to pick up a copy of Unlock Congress, which they can get through Amazon.com, right, among other places.
Absolutely.
And, you've gotten just such good word on it, not just from me because you've been on my Politics Tonight show talking about it, but I've certainly seen other politicians and others who really think you just tapped into something people need to know about. And now that we see Congress being relied upon more than ever by this president, the book becomes even more important for people to check it out. Unlock Congress is the book. My guest, Michael Golden, thank you for being with me, and we'll talk to you again soon, both on podcast and TV.
If I can make it there, I'm gonna make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York.
Ah, the fabulous sound of Frank Sinatra. And while I would love to tell you we have Frank on the podcast today, you know that's not possible since Frank has left us years ago. But we've got the next best thing. We've got the guy who does a knock-your-socks-off impression of Frank Sinatra. You just heard it, actually. And that is Chicago's very own Ron Hocking, who has been appearing here for so many years as well as around the country, but I go way back to his, I believe, his first show, which was called His Way, a tribute to the man and his music. And you know, Sinatra's kind of where he made his name, I think. But today, he's so much more and extending his performance and his repertoire so much further. And you are going to get to see him, that you can go see him, over at the Apollo Theater as he's running through September and into at least the beginning of October for just an incredible night of entertainment in a remounted show called The Men and Their Music. Ron Hawking, what an honor to have you on the podcast. Thank you, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me. What a fabulous introduction, Paul. That was... I'm looking around here going, oh, is that – he's talking about me? Come on.
Well,
thank you so much. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm grateful.
Well, you're welcome, but it's heartfelt because, I mean, you're just – again, you are a Chicago – I know you grew up in the area, and although you play all over the world, but this is home for you. And this is actually a remount, right? This Men and Their Music, you did this about 10 years ago, I think.
Yeah, this is the 10th anniversary celebration of the Men and Their Music, and I'm often asked, Ron, who are these men? Well, these men are the legendary singers, songwriters, performers that inspired me throughout my career with their artistry, and I decided to put a compilation together, and it is no longer just a tribute to Frank Sinatra, although I could not fire Dean, Sammy, and Frank. They make a cameo in the show. And but there are a number of other well-known artists that and their music throughout the show. And without giving it all away,
we want to keep some secrets here. Okay.
Yeah, well, we have a nice running order of things, a refreshed running order of, we have some Gershwin, we have some Michael Bublé, we have some Tony Bennett.
Yeah.
And Billy Joel, Elton John, their music.
I'm going to step in a little bit because I also know you do Burt Bacharach.
Yeah, we have a Burt Bacharach segment that has a lot of his great songs that were written by him and he and Hal David.
Right.
Ray Charles, a genius in my mind.
So you're bringing back all the greats, by the way. You know, I was at recently the 40th anniversary for the Black Ensemble Theater, and Dionne Warwick performed.
Wonderful.
Had a chance to spend some time with her, and of course, if people, depending on their age and as they're listening to this, Dionne Warwick is synonymous with Burt Bacharach and Hal David. But, you know, there's a consistency. When you talk about the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra and Dean, Sammy, those guys, but then you talk about Tony Bennett and Ray Charles' mothers. I mean, you're talking about the classiest of music. It's taken us back in many ways to Vegas in the 60s and the 70s, and that's just an era. I was little for that, but I still kind of miss it.
A great time period in music, and the Sands Hotel and the Copa Room at the Sands Hotel. You know, the show has got a lot of diversity in it, and one of the things that I wanted to share with you is that there was a song that we all know and grew up to, a love song by the Moody Blues, Nights in White Satin.
Oh, yeah.
And I have a new rendition of that, and I perform it in Italian.
Really?
And it's very special. And I recorded the song in February. I heard it. I was inspired by a Greek artist. His name is Mario Frangoulis. And I heard him sing it. And I said, I have to learn this song because it is so beautiful. No matter that it's in a foreign language, we all get the music of it. And we've got a wonderful variation on the theme. It was originally recorded in 3/4 time. Our rendition is in 4/4 time. Ah. And it's a kind of a Latin-esque kind of feel.
I love it. So you didn't take it back to its original Yiddish? No,
I did not.
Just throwing it that way. Well, look, I know you're keeping some secrets, but I'm going to have to give one of these away because one of the folks you pay tribute to, because one of the names you haven't said yet, but I'm going to play a little of this. So
okay.
I got to do this to you.
Right.
And that is, of course, the late but the very great Nat King Cole,
sure,
who makes his appearance. And so let's listen to a little bit of Ron as Nat.
Unforgettable. That's what you are. Unforgettable.
I love it. Now people ask as we follow that. But, yeah. So as we hear Natalie, by the way, because we're just getting an audio check, we're not seeing it. How's that happening on stage?
Well, actually, that is in a segment that I have reworked, and it's a dedication to my dad, because when I was growing up, my mom and dad both sang, but they weren't professionals. We had a lot of music in our house when I was growing up. And when we would go on car trips, my dad would, you know, belt out a song because we had the radio on, and he would sing along with the radio. And then sometimes my mother would turn down the radio if a Perry Como song came on. My mother would turn down the radio a bit and say, "Frank, sing like Perry Como." And my dad would do a little Perry Como and also Nat Cole. And so that's how I work those two voices into the show. I talk about my growing up and realizing that I could do voices too, and so that's where I step into some character as the yeah. segment continues.
Do you see yourself? You know, when I describe you, and I was sort of planning for this interview, and even when I talk about you, I don't say impressionist and singer. You're a singer to me first. Is that fair?
Yeah, I'm
to
a
you?
Singer first, actually.
Yeah, okay.
And thank you for saying that, because that's the way I like to be thought of. You know. Inspirationally, Sammy Davis Jr. did impersonations in his show, and I didn't really want to be an impressionist, although I did put a corporate show together that was called The Lively Art of Impressionism, and I worked a lot of corporate events doing impressions, but I never wanted to be just an impressionist. So, but I like music so much, and you know, I started out in Chicago on TV as a kid. It was called the Morris B. Sachs Amateur Hour. And I was 4 years old, and I was singing a Mario Lanza song, the title song to the movie Because You're Mine.
I love it.
And I share that with the audience. I have a little clip in the show that I will share.
Oh,
with
of you
the
as
audience.
A kid?
So, you know, I've been doing this a while,
yeah.
Paul. And I'm so thrilled to be back on stage at the Apollo Theater. I've never played the Apollo. This is my first time there.
Oh, it's a great theater.
But to take my creation from 10 years ago and rework it and have the thrill of being there and doing it again is a great honor for me.
Oh, well, there's no question. And it is a great theater. A Million-Dollar Quartet played there for about 47 years. And
yeah.
I hope that extends on you. You know, we're about out of time, but I had one more clip. I'm just going to sneak this in here if we can.
Okay.
So I'll warn Brett, my producer, to get it ready. And because it's within this world of music and time of music, but it's a little bit different than what we've been listening to. So I'll invite my listeners to see if they can figure out who this is.
Our first group had a lead singer who had a falsetto that used to drive my father up a wall and my mother running for cover. They had a big hit in September of 1962, and here they are to do it for you. Yeah!
Oh, I love it. And by the way,
Frankie Valli and
yeah.
the Four Seasons,
but
they
you
are
also,
definitely part of our culture.
You also give us a bonus voice. Now, I caught it. You have a bonus voice because that introduction is Casey Kasem's voice.
That's right. Right.
See? A little bonus that we get in there.
This segment called American Top 40 Radio, and it has a lot of 60s stars in there, including Joe Cocker and Roy Orbison and Kenny Rogers.
So many great voices.
You.
Well, if you're from that generation, you're not from that generation, it doesn't matter. I have seen Ron perform, and it's a fantastic show. You don't want to miss it. It's over at the Apollo Theater, Chicago, which is just a great place anyway to go. And you can get tickets at apollochicago.com. You'll see the performance schedule there. If you want to know more about Ron, he's recorded some CDs. Can we get CDs at the theater, too? I would hope so.
Absolutely. Okay. I have my latest CD called The Song Is You that was nominated to the category of Best Traditional Pop Vocalist at the Grammys. And, yes, they will definitely be there and for sale. And
well, I'll definitely be trying to distract the seller and steal it from. No, I'm kidding. I'll definitely going to buy that when I go there as well. You can also check Ron out at ronhawking.com. It's his own website, of course, Ron Hawking, HawkingK-I-N-G.com. Check him out there. Ron, thanks for spending time with me. I can't wait. Actually, as people are listening to this, to be honest, your show's opening tonight as we speak, as people hear this. It's going to run through the beginning of October, but who knows? Maybe you'll get extended. Go to ronhawking.com to find out the dates, but don't miss it. Check it out. You want a great evening out and a lot of fun in a great neighborhood, too. This is the place to go. Ron Hawking.
We hope to extend, and the music transcends all generations.
Very true, and certainly mine. I can tell you that. The men and their music at the Apollo Theater. Ron, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate
you. Thank you, Paul.
Incredible talent.
See you soon, sugar. Thanks to you, Bonnie, babe. I can make plans again. I got lots of reasons to living. It's true that love can set you free, and this world will remember me.
You said you'd go straight, Clyde. I wanna be in movies. I can't name one movie star who's doing robberies on the side. I know in my heart, babe, that Hollywood is calling. How can I be in the spotlight if we always have to hide?
We'll need some. I could just keep listening to this. I just love that music. But we got to start talking. And you might have heard some names in there to figure out exactly what this is from. It is from the Chicago premiere of a great musical called Bonnie and Clyde. Is it about Bonnie and Clyde, that Bonnie and Clyde? Yes, it is. And that song kind of says it all, because these are folks who wanted to make a name for themselves. Clyde, who's all about Al Capone. Bonnie, who's all about a old actress you may or may not remember the name of, Clara Bow. I don't remember her from firsthand, but I know the name. And it's this great show that talks about the story of Bonnie and Clyde put to music, appeared on Broadway with Jeremy Jordan, among others, as I remember. But it's in Chicago, and you got a chance to see it. It's a Kokandi production. It's playing at the theater building on Belmont, and what a treat it is. So I'm joined by the leads of the show, the director of the show. I'm excited. Let's get to them. Let me start by introducing the director, Spencer Neiman, who actually, you have done Kokandi productions before, I know, and have also done so many things working with Griffin Theater, Hypocrites, Windy City Playhouse, so many great things. Spencer, welcome to the podcast, and I imagine that doing Bonnie and Clyde was a great deal of fun for you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. And let's get to Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie, played by Desiree Gonzalez, her first performance with Kokandi, but certainly not new to the world of theater. She's done so many great shows like Seussical, Another Word for Beauty, Over at the Goodman, just on and on, and work that she's done. But this has to be a really great role for you, Desiree, to play such an incredible character of Bonnie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also joining us, playing Clyde, Max Detagny. I got it right? I knew I wouldn't mess this up.
Detagny.
See, it took me the third time, but I did say it right. I spelled it right.
Oh, God.
And also his Kokandi debut, but and he's been in Chess and Porchlight. I saw you in that in the Revisit series, Jesus Christ Superstar over Theo Ubake. Such great work. Max, welcome to the podcast to you as well.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what a great show. It didn't play for a very long time on Broadway, but so glad it's been brought here. And actually, Spencer, I don't know if this was one of the reasons it was being produced this year, but if my memory serves correct, aren't we around the 50th anniversary of the movie of Bonnie and Clyde? Does that have anything to do with this?
I don't think that's the exact reason that we chose to do it this year, but it was, you are correct, that it is the anniversary.
Ah, okay. So, let's talk about Bonnie and Clyde. Listen, maybe not everybody knows who Bonnie and Clyde are, so Max, I'll come to you. These were bank robbers. These were, you know, and yet the show plays. We actually fall in love with, I think, I really like Bonnie and Clyde. You want them to survive it, except we know how it comes out in the end. But Max, talk to me a little bit about playing the role of Clyde, because this is a guy who, it's like he's all about Al Capone. That's who he wants to be. He wants to have dinner with Al Capone.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's been a real challenge, a real treat. He's always on edge because he's so desperate. He grows up in this poor socioeconomic area and is forced to do whatever means possible to get what he wants and get what he believes he deserves.
And then separately from him is Bonnie, Desiree, your character. They didn't grow up together. They meet eventually. But what an interesting woman, because she herself has a dream. Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I always assume actors do a kind of a little bit of homework. But did you take some time, just because I know you're young, did you take some time to find out who Clara Bow is or was? Because this is somebody who Bonnie Parker is obsessed with.
Yeah, absolutely. I looked into a couple of the references that we make in the show, some movies that she was in, and looked up some pictures, because, and Spencer asked me to do this as well. So, yeah, I definitely did. Of course, she was a huge influence on Bonnie.
And wanted to be a huge star. Spencer, I got to tell you, you know, the space that you're in, it's a smaller space. The theater itself, it's a smaller space. One of the things that really impressed me is the set design piece. Now, I know you're not the set designer, but still, you're the director of the show. It was amazing. In working with this small stage area, you had everything from a jailhouse to a home to a hotel room. Was that a challenge up front to create so many different scenes working with the space that you had?
Absolutely. So that was actually one of the first things that I had to figure out when I started preparing to direct this show, because this is not one of those plays that takes place in the living room. It honestly, I don't have an exact tally, but it feels like there are 45 locations in this play. So one of the first things I did with the script is I sat down and I figured out exactly what I needed to from the set to make sure that we had enough to help the audience understand where we were. And obviously we're not bringing on huge sets because it's a small, like, 99 seat theater,
right?
But figuring out the barest elements of what we would need to put us in the space of the hideout, or in his brother's house, or in Bonnie's mom's house, or in a bank, or in a grocery store, or in the forest, really just so many locations. But so that was the first thing I did.
And Max and Desiree, I'll start with Desiree with you on this time. One of the things that really struck me, and I went to see the show with a friend, and she noticed the same thing, which was when there are these numbers, which are ballads, duets, between, you know, say, Bonnie and her sister-in-law, the brothers. What powerful numbers, what powerful moments those are. Those are just great theater. What is your take on that, Desiree?
They were so much fun to do. Also a challenge, because obviously there's a reason why they sing these songs. They say these words. They hold weight. And so it was a challenge to kind of go back to the text and figure out exactly what they needed from these songs and what they meant and what they wanted to get across and what they wanted from the other character. So it's been a challenge, but it's been a lot of fun, and everyone is so helpful, and Spencer's been so helpful, and Missy is a great co-star, and so is Max. So it was actually a really collaborative process, and it was great.
Yeah,
we eventually got there.
Totally. And the other thing that I love, Max, was there's a lot of humor in this show. I mean, I don't know if Bonnie and Clyde were funny or you know, or had humorous lives. But talk to me a little bit, Max, about, I mean, it seems to be the goal of the show. It's a Spencer question, too. But you want the audience to like you. We're not hoping Bonnie and Clyde meet their demise here. We're actually kind of hoping you get it together and somehow you win. It's just that history doesn't let you do that.
Yeah, it is funny. Our first time we had an audience, they were laughing, and I walked backstage and asked people what show we were doing. It was a very, very strange reaction. But I think what we bring to it is an honest. These are just two people who are down on their luck. You know, they don't have what the means that these other people have that they grow up with, and so it's just two regular people who are forced to do these horrible, horrible things. But I think the way we approach it humanizes them a little bit more than just calling them criminals. And
yeah. Now, on the other hand, you know, Clyde, it looks like wanting to be a bad guy is something that he's enamored with, as I said, the Al Capone fixation. But Desiree,
right. For
Bonnie, it's different. I mean, she's wanting to be a movie star, but it's interesting how in her mind and in your character, you somehow, Bonnie gets to create this tie between, well, I get to be that person on the front page of the newspaper. This is just a different way to get there, Robin Banks.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. That was a little bit of a challenge to navigate because she does initially have that dream. And then I think that changes at a certain point in the show when she and Clyde are in pretty deep, and you know they Clyde commits a murder and she wants to leave and get out, but then within the same song she changes her mind and she decides to stay, and she says, "Well, this is how I'm gonna make it." And I think in my mind she's kind of starring in her own movie at that point. She's like, "Well, this is better than just wasting away as a waitress." You know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly. And she and they build that bond. Spencer, I have to ask you, this is my take on it. But, you know, first of all, the ensemble is fantastic and people doing different roles. Mm-hmm. But playing young Bonnie is African-American actress. And her name is, remind me, who plays young Bonnie?
Pinson.
Yes. So but what's really interesting about that is because as I saw that at first when I because we see her before we see adult Bonnie, and I thought, OK, you've cast Bonnie as an African-American. My mind went to Hamilton, right, where everything is what I would say colorblind, although Lin-Manuel Miranda actually says, no, it's not colorblindness, it's color intensive. But just talk to me a little bit, Spencer, in terms of the casting. That, so it wasn't a concern with you. We're going to give the role to whoever gets it, and I think it's fantastic for theater when we're no longer – I guess we're still concerned about what gender is playing what gender, but it seems to be that race, factors like that just don't seem to matter as much anymore. I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, for me, it was so important to cast this play in a way that reflects the world that we live in currently, and I think that these characters are really interesting because – I find there to be so much similarity in terms of the stakes of their lives versus the stakes of many people's lives today in terms of poverty and consistently being brought down and forced down by the status quo and by the way the systems work against poor people. And so I really saw a lot of echoes of today reflected in this show. And so that came into play when I was thinking about the way I was going to approach the text.
Yeah.
And then also with casting, I think it's important to have a cast that reflects the world that we live in and the city that we live in. And we're doing a musical, and people come into the theater and they suspend disbelief to invest themselves in a story that we're telling. And that's part of the beauty of theater, is that you don't have, not everything is, we know it's not real. And so we can tell the stories that we want to tell as we want to tell them, and aren't locked in by what race these people were back when they were alive. Because if so, the whole cast would have been white, and that isn't interesting to me.
And by the way, on the gender play, because I said you don't play with gender, but you do, because you actually have a governor back then played by a woman, which probably was not
the
case.
She actually was female.
Oh, she was a female governor at that time?
She was a female governor at that time.
Oh.
Yeah, one-term governor.
Oh, good for her.
Which is surprising. Her husband had been the governor, and then he got out. He was somebody else was elected, and then she came in a couple terms later. But we did actually have some swapping of genders. There's a sharpshooter in the play who was male but played by a female-identifying actress. And also some of the bank tellers and shopkeepers in the original production were all played by men, but my ensemble was a little bit smaller, and I thought it would be interesting to have some awesome actors who are female-identifying play these characters.
Yeah, why not? Now, I also know, Spencer, we're not going to get into politics, but I wear the political hat here at WGN, and I know you are
Absolutely.
Active in politics, and you were involved
yeah.
in that. And so what I'm hearing as you describe the show is you get their sort of underlying political social themes here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I want to actually come over to Max and Desiree for this. Max, as you looked at the role of Clyde, are you impacted by that, by sort of the commentary that is going on really about socioeconomic class, those kinds of things? Or for you, and Desiree, same question, is like, no, I got a character to play. We got a story to tell. That's what we're doing here on stage.
I mean, I think it's always in the back of your mind. It definitely, they bring it up a few times about the poor are poor and there's nothing
yeah.
for them. They're never going to inherit anything. They've been told that if they wait and are patient, they'll inherit the earth or follow some other story. And it's not true. They're just going to continue to be beat down.
And Desiree, how about you? Same as Max or different?
No, absolutely the same. I think these two characters were definitely victims of their circumstances.
And yet there's a story to tell. Well, it's so well done. So Bonnie and Clyde, the musical, is playing at Theater Wit over on Belmont, and people can get tickets at CoCandyProductions.com. I think sometimes people will wonder where the name CoCandy comes from, but it actually comes from, right, Scott CoCandy, right, who's the executive producer.
Correct.
Yeah, well, I might as well name it after him. but anyway, so, but I'll spell it, K-O-K-A-N-D-Y, K-O-K-A-N-D-Y. It's all one word, CoCandyProductions.com. The box office can be called at 773-975. I think it's 8150. Do I have that right? I'm pretty sure, 8150, over at the Theater Wit box office. Now, it's scheduled to run through October 15th, so people have time to see it, but I don't know, any chance, Spencer, any word about extensions, or we don't know, or definitely not, or what do we know?
I think I'll try to go see it before October 15th.
That's what I would say. You got to see it. It's like Hamilton. You never know if it's going to be around or not. Go see it. But Bonnie and Clyde over at the Theater Wit. It's really great. And I love the fact that not all great theater has to be down in the loop. You can come on up to Lakeview and see great shows up there. I was always, and actually I've seen other CoCandy productions. The Full Monty, I think, was a season ago or so. I just love the stuff that CoCandy does, just working with you know, intimate spaces, great performers. And so I know, Max and Desiree, this is your first performance with CoCandy. It won't be your last. And I wish you all the best with this one. So don't miss Bonnie and Clyde. It was a show that I had heard of but had never seen, and now I'm really glad I did. Check it out, CoCandyProductions.com. Get tickets and see it before October 15th over at Theater Wit. Max DeTogne and Desiree Gonzalez and Spencer Neiman, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Have a great run. Congratulations. It's such a fabulous show. I loved it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Can I audition to be Clyde's understudy, by the way?
Sure, yeah. You can go on all next week.
That's right. Hey, I just been told I'm on all next week, so come see me. We're kidding, folks. I'm not really doing it. Guys, thank you. Don't miss Bonnie and Clyde. Great show, and I appreciate your time. Thanks, everybody. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.